with our blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, asher bachar banu mikol hamim, v'natan lanu et torato. Baruch atah Adonai, noten haTorah. This week, we are going to be finishing the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis, and we are concluding with the final parsha, which is called Vayechi, which means, and he lived. Jacob lived on page 269, and it sounds a little bit like Chaye Sara, of the life of Sarah, but we're talking about the life of Yaakov, life of Jacob, but he is still alive at the beginning of this parsha. He is not passing away until the end, but we're talking about the life of Yaakov in the land of Egypt. This parsha is called a closed parsha. We have talked about this before in previous years, but it's just always interesting to revisit it, and we're going to look at it from a slightly different perspective. I brought what's called a tikkun, which is what people who are reading Torah, how they prepare their Torah readings. It has, on one column, it has the how we see the text in the Hebrew with the vowels and punctuation and the trump markings, and then on the other side, it has the way it's written in a Torah scroll so someone can practice transferring that, going from side to side. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to actually carry this tikkun around. I want to show you how the Parsha Vayechi begins, because it is unique among all the Parshas of the Torah in that there is no break in between last week's Parsha of Vayigash and this week's Parsha of Vayechi. Makes it a little hard. Some people are, you know, you ever see people rolling the Torah and looking for the Parsha, you can kind of always tell, because it's like some benchmark spacings, and a new Parsha always starts on a new line, or at least 9 letter spaces, so you can always find it. With the exception of Vayechi, you can't really find so easily. In fact, I'm saying, like, where is this? So I found it, but I want to show it to you how it looks, so you can just get an idea of just the visual of how this Parsha is structured. So, the word Vayechi is right there, and so it starts right literally, there's one extra space the way it goes after the end of Parsha Vayigash. So there's the beginning of Parsha Vayechi, and you see for the beginning of any other Parsha there is always a huge space. I just want you to see this, because of course we're going to comment on this, of why is this Parsha closed. So there's the word Vayechi next to the last word of the previous Parsha. So it's very cool and interesting. Of course, somebody did the last word of Vayigash, Vayechi. No spaces, nothing. It just goes right from one to the next. So we're going to be talking about what is this closeness about. There's the word Vayechi. There's the last word of the last Parsha.
How did they know it was supposed to be a different Parsha?
Ah, there's one space.
Wow.
That's enough to listen. And the also knowing, because of our oral tradition, of knowing what the different parshas are, so that we know what.
And also, there have been enough for the weeks of the year without.
You could always have divided it some other place, you know, because there's other breaks in the parsha, so you could have said, oh, maybe it starts here. So why would it start? We know it starts there, but it's closed. But why does it start there, and why is it closed? So the idea of closing kind of raises the question of why are there any spaces for the rest of the Torah? That's really the question. What do the spaces do? So if you think about it, for people who are writers, why do you make paragraph breaks? Why do you start something with a new sentence? Why do you skip lines? Or even in an email, why might you skip a number of spaces before you go on to whatever you're going to say? What is the purpose of the space? Which will then tell us why there's no space.
To separate out,
and what do you do during that time of separation?
Pause.
Okay? The pause is about taking something in and about absorbing what the message is and having a moment to think, which is why if you, again, even in the email, since you don't have, it's not a real conversation, if you have a topic and then you might go down 10 spaces and say, oh, you know, by the way, blah, 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 and say something else. So the pause in and of itself tells you that that's a time for contemplation, meditation, reflection, take in the message, etc. So now that tells us, excuse me, that there's something about this week's parsha where there's no pause, that we're going, there's no time to stop now, because now something is getting started, something's going to be happening to the Jewish people, beginning with the beginning of this parsha, where there's not going to be time to stop, there's not going to be a time for any kind of reflection at all. And that is the life of, as soon as Yaakov comes down to Egypt with his family, with the 70, it's really the beginning of the exile. Even though he's coming down to be reunited with Yosef, with Joseph, and it's a very happy, wonderful occasion, the truth is it's really the beginning of the down part of the descent of the exile, the hardship and the difficulty of the Jewish people, and that closed aspect of the parsha is understood to mean that the Jewish people were going to become closed up, and they were going to be becoming insensitive and impervious to God's presence, that they were going to start assimilating. The whole thing was going to get started. Even though it doesn't look like it's starting now, it's actually starting now. So we were actually entering into a period of deep darkness. And there's no room, there's no light coming in. The space represents kind of like, you know, like the window opening. Like there's a little crack of light that gives you a time to see what it was you just heard. Now there's not going to be any space. It's just going to be the beginning of, not the beginning of the end, because the beginning of this decline, of this going down, is in the end going to be really the beginning of the redemption, because every decline is really the beginning of a redemption. So this whole parsha is coming to tell us that when it looks like it is totally going to be a time of darkness, there's really going to be something else going on as well, even though you're not going to be able to see it. It looks like there's no cracks, there's no opening, there's no place, but really within that darkness, there's going to be tremendous light that is going to be hiding in there. And it's being hidden in the words that we're going to learn about today in the description of Yaakov's life and what's going on in Egypt. So the parsha starts out on page 269, and let's take a look at verse 28, and then that will help launch us there. Naomi, would you like to read that for us? Verse 28, the first verse in the parsha.
Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, in the days of Jacob, the years of his life, the 147 years.
Okay, so what do we know about Jacob? How long did he live in Egypt?
17 years,
and how old was he totally when he passes away? 147. So now what's very interesting is just on the words, Vayechi, and he lived in the land, that's a strange word to use for Jacob's living in the land, because it's really related to the word chai. You can see the word chai, vayechi, and he lived in the land, because Yaakov was a sojourner. He lived in like hu gar, like lagur means to live or to dwell. It's like epawat gara. You don't say, ani chai be Magnolia Street, like I live on Magnolia Street. I'm sorry?
To reside.
To reside. So the idea is, even though it says Jacob lived in the land, it's not he lived there like, here's my address in Goshen. It's he lived there, that there was a life force that he injected into the land of Egypt while he was there, that was to prepare the world, to prepare Egypt to be a place where the Jewish people would be able to persevere. Because how long did Yaakov think the Jewish people were going to be in the land of Egypt? Based on the prophecy that was given to Abraham, bless you, in 400 years. That's a long time to withstand the challenges of living in the superpower of the time, which was a place of incredible glamour and glitz and decadence. It was a place that was going to be very challenging, and even if it wasn't going to be oppressive, it would be a place of incredible risk of assimilation. There was just challenges at every corner. 400 years, Yaakov needed to do something. If you knew your children were going into a place that was going to be a challenge for them, you'd want to do everything you could to prepare the way so that they would be able to withstand it, because there's nothing else you can do. But that is something you can do. So when it says, Vayechi Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim, and he lived in the land of Egypt for that amount of time, it's he injected life force, he injected spirituality, he injected light into the darkness of what would be Mitzrayim for the Jewish people, so they would have access to it even in their time of darkness. Now, we know after the fact that he was successful, because there was a Jewish people that survived all that, and luckily it was only 210 years rather than 400, but think about 210 years, even in the course of the existence of the United States. How old is the United States now? Where are we up to? 200-something. You know, a lot can happen in 200 years. It's half than 400. It's half of 400, but it's still a really long time for a people to exist and to be able to persevere and emerge successfully. So he put in this tremendous amount of life force and spiritual light. We have another hint to the idea that it was a spiritual light that he infused, the light of Torah, and that he was able to, through his instruction to his children and to his grandchildren and his family, and even his mere presence was something that changed Egypt and what was going to be there. It says that he lived there how many years?
17.
So the truth is, Torah is not a history book. And the Torah did not need to tell us that he lived there 17 years because we could have figured that out by ourselves. How could we know this? So we know already that he lived to be 147 years old. That's how it was the length of his life. But if you go back into Parsha Vayigash just last week, if you go back to page 265, we have an unusual conversation between Jacob and Pharaoh. Pharaoh asks him, it's not exactly the most polite question, when he meets Yaakov, when Yaakov comes down to Egypt to be reunited with Yosef, the Pharaoh says, like, how old are you? Because he looked really old. So Jacob answers Pharaoh, verse 9 on page 265. Beth Ann, would you like to read that for us? The days of the years of my life.
The days of the years of my life. And they had not reached the lifespans of my forefathers in the days of their sojourn.
Okay, that sentence requires and deserves a lot of other explanation and commentary, which we're not going to go into. But basically, we're given a number. When he arrives in Egypt, how old is he?
130.
And now 2 pages later, it says that he lived to be 147. So what do I already know? How long was he in Egypt? 17 years. So you don't need to tell me Jacob lived there for 17 years. So what do we need to know from that? So this is based on the comment, Shir from Rabbi Abba Wagensberg, based on the commentary of the Gur Aryeh, who says that 17 years is a hint to us about what he was doing during those 17 years. It has to do with what he was trying to accomplish during those 17 years. It's not just saying, oh, I'm here 17 years. As an aside, in the Midrash Rabbah, in the Midrash that goes along with this Parsha, there is a comment by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, who was the one who was responsible for putting down in writing the Talmud. Okay, he was the one who wrote it down. And why did he write it down? Do we know why he wrote it down? So it wouldn't be lost in the face of exile. It was in anticipation of the exile. The Jewish people would be scattered, and he needed to do something to make sure that the oral law, which is Judaism, not the, quite frankly, the Torah, the oral law is what is the nuts and bolts and the meat of Judaism. It had to be written down lest it be forgotten. So Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi in the Midrash on this Parsha says, I lived for 17 years in Tzipori, which is a place in Israel. I'm just like Yaakov. It's like, well, I lived 17 years, you know, in Los Angeles. Does that make me also like Yaakov? So it's like, so why does that make you like Yaakov? It says that he was saying that what they did during those 17 years was the same. As preparation of preparing spiritual light to be able to be a place, a beacon of light for the Jewish people, so during the exile they would not be destroyed. So the 17 years, it's like, so what's 17? So, okay, granted, maybe the same. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, he does his things for the Jews later, and he's saying, I'm just like Yaakov when Yaakov was also for 17 years. But the 17 is a hint, and it goes to the gematria of 17. And there's two different ways we're going to look at it. One is that 17 is the same gematria for the word tov. Okay? So tov is 17. So that's good. You could say you could accept it just at that level and say, what was Yaakov doing there is for 17 years he was infusing and putting in goodness into the Jewish people and into the land so that they would have access to a spiritual connection while they were there. But it goes deeper than that, because if we go back to, you can put your string there, and go back to Bereshit, back to the very, very beginning of Bereshit, we see that in the description of creation, the word tov is used, good. And where's the first time? You may even know this off the top of your head. What's the very first thing that God says is good? And if you can look, the light, okay? And so it says in verse 3, God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw that the light was good. That's the first time the word tov appears in the Torah, is in the description of light. This light we know is not the sun, the stars, or any other kind of astronomical thing. It is spiritual light that was created, because the planets and everything else weren't created until a later date of the creation. So this is called a light, a spiritual light. This light was also the same light that we refer to in Hanukkah, because the word or, which is light, is the 25th word in Bereshit and is a hint to the 25th day of Kislev, which is when Hanukkah starts. It says, what kind of light is Hanukkah about? It's about this same kind of light. It's about this spiritual light that is supposed to permeate the world, but where is it always in conjunction with? It's always in conjunction with darkness. So we see here God called to the light and to the darkness he called night. I'm sorry, he called to the light day and the darkness he called night. And that there was darkness before the creation of light, and even after the creation of light, there was this light and darkness combination that we call day and night. But because we're so used to differentiating that either it's a time of darkness, or it's a time, or that's interesting because that means light, or it is a time of light, and the two things are mutually exclusive, this parsha is coming to say, not so. The Parsha of Vayechi is coming to say, within the darkness there is light, and in fact the light that exists within darkness is the most powerful light that there is, because it has to be the most powerful light, because it has to be able to exist within the darkness and not be completely consumed by it. So what Yaakov is infusing is this spiritual light that was at the beginning of creation, that he is capturing that through his deep spiritual connection, and he is infusing it into the Jewish people and into Egypt so that there would be a source of light for everyone to connect to throughout the entire time of their enslavement and their oppression in the land of Egypt. So this idea of 17 goes to the idea of Tov, and the Tov, which references back to the Or, says this is what the 17 means. There's another gematria that's based on what's called a mispar katan, which means the little number, literally. And what this is in gematria, there is a way of analyzing numbers or words where you take a gematria, but if something has a zero in it, like 10, you drop the zero and you're left with what's called the mispar katan, which is 1. So if you take the name of God, which is the Yud, He, and Vav, He name, the Yud is equal to 10, which then reverts to in Mispar Katan, becomes 1. He is equal to 5, so now what do we have? 5 plus 1? 6. Vav is equal to 6, so now what do we have altogether? 6 plus 6 is 12, and then the final He is equal to 5. So 12 plus 5 equals 17. Says, what was it that Yaakov was putting into the Jewish people and into the land of Egypt to create an anchor, a spiritual light, and Hashem, to put in a sense of godliness and connection? Because we have to remember, we're looking back from history, from a place of looking back after everything happened, and we're evaluating how the Jewish people did. This was before the giving of Torah. There was going to be no real, quote, Jewish leadership. How were these people supposed to survive? How could they have access to any spiritual light unless it's somehow infused in the very fabric of Mitzrayim, of Egypt, into the people so that they have access to it? So that's why it uses the number 17, because then it can allude to both ideas in a hidden way. And the hiddenness is the whole point, is that the light is hidden in the darkness. It's not obvious. In fact, it would have been a little oxymoronic if it would have said, and Jacob sowed light in the darkness. It's like, Well, that's the whole point, is in the darkness, it looks like there is no light. It doesn't look like it's there. And Yaakov's goal and Yaakov's job is that he's there to prepare the way so that there would be the teaching of God, who the Levites became in charge of doing. The tribe of Levi took that on as a priesthood while they were in Egypt, even before they were the official Levites. They did that. And the Jewish people learned Torah. So they had to have a way for that to happen. Naomi.
What each of the numbers represented again, real quick?
Yes, 17 equals Tov.
Right.
And 17 equals also Hashem's name in Mispar Katan using the Yud. The Yud, which is equals to 10, becomes 1.
Okay.
He is 5. Vav is 6. And He is 5. And that equals 17.
What a simple idea about Mispar
Katan.
You drop the zero?
You drop the zero. There's another way of doing Mispar Katan, which is that you... there's another form of Mispar Katan where you keep reducing a number until you get to a single digit, the smallest digit. So you can do that by a single letter, or you can do it by a whole word. There's a fascinating, wonderful thing. I love to share this. Like, every time I think about it, I love it. All the things that we associate with Shabbos, like the Zachor at Yom HaShabbat, Nair, candle, Yayin, wine, Challah, dog, fish, and basar, meat. All of those words, if you take each of those words and create their Mispar Katan and reduce them till they're one letter, they all equal 7. Every single one of them. It's like we're eating the concept of sevenness in the things that we're doing that seem like, what's that? You know, you're telling me I'm eating Shabbos when I light my candle, Hadlik Ner, when I make Kiddush over wine, when I have, we're told we're supposed to have Basar V'Dagim, we're supposed to have meat and fish, and all of those things equal 7. So the Mispar Katan is used as another form of analysis in Gematria. It's very interesting. So that's that idea. So same thing with Hashem's name, is that Yaakov was infusing that into the Jewish people with the light of Torah as he already knew it through just having inherited it from Abraham, Yitzchak, and now himself Yaakov, and into his children. So that is the beginning of the light that Yaakov has. So this concept, yes, Susan?
You mentioned that there was no real Jewish leadership. I guess that comes with Moshe.
With Moshe. Yes, they were learning Torah. So it says that they were, so the tribal, like the heads of the families were the leaders, but there wasn't a document. So there wasn't a written Torah. There was the tradition that had been inherited and the knowledge, but it was a little bit unstructured from that perspective. So it was hard. But they said, why did the Jewish people merit to be redeemed from Egypt? It said they did not change their names throughout that. All that time, they kept Hebrew names, not Egyptian. We don't see Egyptian names except for Moshe, actually. And they dressed in a modest way and in a distinctive way, so they did not assimilate into Egyptian culture. And they did acts of chesed, acts of kindness for one another. So they did all the things that kept them identified as a unique people. And that's not easy to do. And they maintained the values of and the moral purity that was what they had learned from Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. And they kept that and did not assimilate into the Egyptian culture. Now, that was only 20% that didn't assimilate. 80% did, and those people did not leave Egypt, and they died in the plague of darkness, and that was the end of them. So this was, it still, there was a remnant of people who were able to persevere. But Yaakov sets it up so that there could be anybody at all. I mean, you think about how much money we invest in Jewish education, Jewish camps, Jewish neighborhoods, synagogue, whatever, and it's still challenging to get the results we want. How do you do that when you don't have that? It's like there better be something to tap into. So this spiritual light is what Yaakov was in charge of doing, and that there would be teaching, that there would be instruction. In fact, we're told that before they come to Egypt, and just going back to our parsha now in Vayechi, that before that, before Jacob comes down to Egypt, hold on one second. Let me come back and see if I can find it. If you go to page 261. Verse 28. Before Jacob comes down to Egypt at all with the rest of his family, Susan, why don't you read verse 28 there?
He sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to prepare of him devotion.
Okay. So it's like, okay, and they arrived in the region of Goshen. So it says he sent Yehuda ahead of him to Joseph to prepare. It's like what? Get the towels and sheets ready? It's like, what does that mean? So in here it says lahorot, which means to instruct, like the word Torah, like that kind of preparation. So it says set up a yeshiva, set up places of learning. We're not going down to Egypt unless we have a place where the Jewish people, where this family can learn and maintain and continue their connection with God. Still 80%.
That was generations later.
210 years later.
The light was still there?
The light was still there.
What was 80%?
80% of the Jewish people in Egypt did not leave Egypt. They assimilated and they then were died during the plague of darkness.
So that just means it was very challenging.
It was very challenging. That there were 20% is amazing. Look at the Pew study. Okay, you know, we don't have to really have too much of an imagination to like understand what the tremendous challenge was.
So they had already assimilated before the plagues?
Yes, that's why part of the, yes, they had assimilated before the plagues. Yes.
So they weren't slaves.
Who was? Oh no, they were slaves, but they were assimilated slaves.
So they probably had a better life.
Better life than? I don't know.
I mean, if they assimilated from being slaves.
No, they didn't assimilate from being slaves. They assimilated to be. They were. Yeah. Just think about Germany. Were assimilated Jews any better treated and less put to death than religious Jews? No. It's all the same. They were treated the same by the Egyptians, is how they saw themselves. Are you part of this people or are you not part of this people? And they were like, they were not part of it enough to want to be part of it completely. And so they died. So that was the end.
Was it mainly just a belief in one God? Because I'm wondering, they didn't have the Torah yet, so they didn't have all these kind of rules of how to live.
Except they did. So that's what we understand is that, so we say that the patriarchs and matriarchs observed the Torah even before it was given. Because the Torah is, if we had total clarity about reality, observance of Torah would be a natural expression. It's not a, oh, let's have these people do this list of 613 things. Uh-huh. So it says it was observed, it just wasn't obligated yet. It had not been codified and given to them as the written law. So we even have an understanding that Jacob, after he left his family, before he goes to Haran to live with Laban, that he was in the yeshiva of Shaman Aver for 14 years. 14 years, 17 years, some big mountain. It's like, what was he doing? You sit there and say, there's one God, there's one God, there's one God. So it's like the question is, there's that concept, there's one God, has ramifications. It's not just there's one God, there's nothing but God. And there is a God who then has an expectation for humanity. What is that expectation? That's where the Torah is the expression of what that expectation for humanity is. That's what they practiced, and that's what they did.
I'm sure they also learned their history.
Yeah,
I mean,
they would learn the history, but history is irrelevant unless you learn what it was they taught. I mean, it doesn't really help to know, like, yes, you know, like in the history class, like, okay, so we come from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and we know all the people, mm-hmm. and you know the stories, but for what? That doesn't sustain anybody. That's just sentimentality. That doesn't do anything. So they needed to have something to hang on to that created a peoplehood. So that was the other thing, that this darkness is like, well, thanks a lot to God. Like, why did you send us into this darkness and give us this challenge of being able to emerge and tap into a spiritual light that's hiding within darkness? That's where spiritual growth happens. We think spiritual growth would happen better if everything could be nice and easy and comfortable and wonderful for us, and then I'll grow. You know, then I'll have time. I'll be, you know, it'll be the right temperature outside. It'll be, you know, I'll have the right outfit on. You know, it's like how I do sports. It's like, yeah, I'll go cross-country skiing. If it's blue wax and if the sun is out and if the powder is like this, like, then I'll do it. It's like, it can't be like that. It has to be that real growth comes from immersing into the darkness, being sent into the darkness, accessing the spiritual light, and developing oneself with that light in the darkness. That's where the greatest growth happens. And it says the Jewish people were forged into a people, into a nation, through it's called the crucible of Egypt. It's like where you are pressed and where you're squished and where you're challenged. that's where the growth comes. But if you think that it's only a place of darkness, you won't even look for the light. And so this was to tell the Jewish people, it's always, the light is always in the darkness. And it's not just about Egypt, because this is a lesson for the Jewish people of all times and for all of us as individuals as well. Many of us like to have the idea that when my troubles are over, then I will be able to achieve my true purpose. It's like, that's not how it works. The true purpose is discovered in the place of darkness, because there is even a greater light that is hidden within that darkness that you have to be able to find and access. But you wouldn't know to look for it if you didn't know it was there. So if someone said, there's a tremendous treasure of light in this spiritual darkness that you're going through, whatever the challenge is, it could be a family challenge, it could be a medical challenge, it could be a financial challenge, it could be an emotional challenge, it could be any kind of challenge at all. A family challenge, a community challenge, it is in that darkness. Go look for the light, because that's where it is. So this parsha is to tell us, go look for the light. Otherwise we'd say, wow, it's Egypt, it's over. What hope do I have? There's no chance of anything good happening. So this is what Yaakov is able to give that message to the Jewish people in this parsha. And when he gives, yes, Rachel.
It says that 70 family members came from Jacob. How did that turn into 600,000 men
between the ages of 20 and 60.
Right, and that's if 80% even assimilated, so it would be like,
millions.
That's only 20%.
Yes, that's only 20%. Multiple births. It says, as the Egyptians oppressed the Jews more, the births increased. It says that, if you can picture, that women gave birth to 6 children at a time. Yeah, and all the time. The only tribe that did not multiply greatly were the Levites, because they were not oppressed. They were the only tribe that was excluded from the oppression and from the enslavement. Because Pharaoh had an appreciation for clergy. There was like a clergy exception and exemption.
So what did they do?
They studied Torah. They studied our Torah. They studied the Torah before it was given kind of Torah.
Was that?
Was it a written book of some sort? It wasn't written. It was oral. And that was what was passed down. That's what they kept. And they were the leaders. And Moshe and Aaron come from that tribe of Levi. Because you notice that they weren't out there. Aaron wasn't out there being enslaved, because he was part of the tribe of Levi. You would have noticed, like, since when do slaves have entree into Pharaoh's palace to go have a conversation with the head of state? They just waltzed right in. Like, well, who gave them permission? Well, they weren't enslaved. They weren't part of it. None of the Levites were. And so they stayed to be a small tribe because they weren't oppressed, so God didn't give them the benefit then of this extra birth, higher birth rate that he gave the rest of the tribes. The Levites? Oh, yes. Yes, because they were the ones who were the most dedicated. They were the ones who never showed up to even start with the enslavement, because enslavement started as a public works project, and the Jews are always like so into helping everybody and everything. They showed up, and then it turned into enslavement slowly. The Levites were like, I'm not going to that.
Do you think that the 80% the assimilated ones, 80% were depressed by the enslavement because they didn't feel the light?
I think they were impressed with the light of Egypt. They wanted to be assimilated. Assimilated is different than depressed. Depressed, that'd be kind of cruel to say, well, because you were depressed and didn't stay with the program, you can't come. That's not fair. It had to be a choice. It had to be a choice of like, I don't want it. I chose this over that. So it's free choice. And they chose out. Stella, I want to continue.
Sorry, just a quick question. So the
Levites. From the tribe of Levi.
Right. None of them assimilated?
None of them assimilated.
Okay, so that makes sense in every way. Like why they didn't, so they stayed separate. They didn't have to have multiple births because we didn't lose it.
We didn't lose them. And these other ones, these were people, the multiple births were during the oppression, before this, you know, just throughout the entire time there. And the Levites are kind of, they're both praised and criticized for their staying apart. Because they were Levites, you could have had more of an impact on the Jewish people had you not stayed so separate. And that's given as one of the reasons why the Levites in the land of Israel are not given any land. And they live scattered amongst all the Jewish people because they're supposed to be the teachers. So it's great that the teachers are in like their ivory tower staying so pure, but if you're not with your people teaching them, so that's a problem. So it's like mazel tov for not assimilating and could have done better on helping everybody else. So nothing is ever black and white. Things are very, very multiple levels in this. Okay, so going back to, where were we? This preparation and what they were trying to do and finding the spiritual light and understanding for ourselves that there is always spiritual light to be found and that we need to look for it and we need to be courageous. So interestingly, if we look at the names of the last three parshas, so this parsha is Vayechi and Jacob lived. The parsha before was Vayigash, which means and he approached, which was Yehuda approaching Yosef to argue for the life of Benjamin. And the parsha before that was called Miketz. The word Ketz means end, like the end. I think it may be related to the word Kaitz, which means summer, which is like the end of the harvest. You know, like you finish up the plant, that's like the end of the year. That's supposed to be the end of the cycle. And then the fall starts again with our new year, like Rosh Hashanah. So the word Ketz means end. Miketz, so we have the end is the first parsha, Miketz. Vayigash, he approached. Vayechi, and he lived. He says, those three names of the parsha are a mantra for us to have in the face of challenge. Miketz means the end. Like you think it is Miketz. It's the Ketz. It is the end of whatever the situation is. I don't see any hope here. Things are desperate. That was the situation when Yehuda approaches who he doesn't know is Yosef, who he thinks is the Pharaoh's second in command, to really risk his life and engage and step forward and try and challenge Yosef to liberate and not to keep Benjamin, and even saying, take me instead, I'll be your slave for the rest of your life. So what we're supposed to do, when we think it's the Ketz, then that's where you step up. You don't say, oh, well, this is hopeless. My situation is hopeless. There's nothing that can be done. It'll never work out. This relationship is over. It can never improve. So that's when you get the message, Vayigash, and step up. That's what Yehuda does, is step up, and then what happens? Vayechi, there will be life. You will uncover, and out of it, it'll be a complete surprise to you. As it was when Yehuda steps forward, it was Yehuda's plea with Joseph at the time that causes Yosef to not be able to withhold his, to reveal to his brothers who he is. He reveals himself to them, and the entire story turns like that. What they thought was a desperate, no way out situation, all of a sudden turns into redemption. It says, this is going to be the path. Miketz, you thought it was the end. Vayigash, engage, approach, step into your fear, and engage with it, and find the place of light, and go for it. Use everything you've got, and Vayechi, there will be life. And that, in that darkness. So those three parshas are a pattern for us, a mantra for us, of what to do in facing any kind of challenge that we have, and for the Jewish people as well. I think about the challenges that have happened to the Jewish people collectively, even in the past 100 years. It is unbelievable. And you could say out of desperation, the Jewish people are vayigash. They just show up. Even think about Holocaust survivors who went to the land of Israel. I mean, you could say they were forced. They could have, you know, God forbid, they could have had mass suicide saying, you know, this just isn't worth it. It's not worth it. But they just showed up in their rags. And the War of Independence and the Six-Day War. It's like, you just show up with what you've got. And then, like, miracles happen. So, interestingly, the Parsha of Miketz is always, always, always read during Hanukkah. Okay, that is the Parsha, the Shabbos Hanukkah is Shabbos Miketz. It says, that's when you thought it was the end, and that's where the light comes out. But it only happens if you're like the Hashmonaim, the Maccabees, who they stepped up. Like, it was crazy to do that against the Syrian Greeks. Completely crazy. And then what happens? The light comes back. It's like, it's an incredible miracle. So it says, don't give up. And that is the message. So then Jacob goes into, after he knows that this is the part, what's going to be happening, and that he's getting ready to die, the end of his 17 years are up, that he then brings his children to bless them. And he blesses them, but before he blesses all of his children, he first blesses and brings to him Ephraim and Manasseh. And this is the really a pretty crazy thing, which we're just kind of used to, because we say on Friday night, many people have the custom to bless their sons. And what do we what do we do with their sons? It says, let's go to page 273. He's, I'm sorry?
Like Ephraim.
You should be like Ephraim and Manasseh. And not only do we say that, you could think like, oh, maybe we just kind of picked that out. That seems like a really nice thing to say. The Torah itself tells us that we are going to bless our children that way. So on page 273, so let's look at verse 20. And Cindy, would you like to read verse 20? And then it continues on to the next page.
So he blessed them that day, saying, by you shall Israel bless, saying, may God make you like Ephraim and like Manasseh. He put Ephraim before Manasseh.
Okay. So here we're told, Israel is going to bless by you, you, Ephraim and Manasseh, shall Israel bless, saying, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Lots is written about what is it about Ephraim and Manasseh that makes them deserving of reward. So a couple things have been offered. One is that Ephraim, who was the younger, was put before Manasseh in the blessing, and Ephraim and Manasseh was not jealous, and that was like the first time that ever happened. Okay, so it wasn't an Isaac-Ishmael situation. It wasn't a Jacob-Esau situation, so that they had this brotherly love. That was good. That they were born in exile. They're the first ones to be born in exile, and that they did not assimilate, and they stayed strong, is the other idea. But the second idea has such depth to it, because it says, why would we bless our children to be like Ephraim and Manasseh? Why isn't it comparable to the blessing for women, for girls? May you be like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. Why don't we say, may you be like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? We have a sense, we have an understanding in the Torah world of looking at things, that each generation becomes less than the previous generation, not becomes greater. So that the Avot and Imahot, the patriarchs and the matriarchs, were the greatest, and then the Shvatim, the tribes, are lesser than them, and each generation is successively lesser, not greater. So now we're skipping down, not even to the patriarchs and matriarchs, and not even to the tribes, but now we're going to the grandchildren. It's like, who are they? It says, ah, who were they? The fact that they were the ones who lived in the darkness of Egypt and we're able to access the light and that tremendous darkness, that's what we need for our children. Because if the Jewish people are going to be spending a tremendous amount of time in exile, and it's not the people who live in the land of Israel don't use this blessing on their children, they do also. Because even though we're in the land of Israel, things are not exactly the way we would ideally like them to be. They're still in exile. People who in their seders in Israel still say, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim, the next year in Jerusalem. Even if you're sitting in Jerusalem, you could be sitting at the Jerusalem bus station and saying, next year in Jerusalem. So what are you saying? It's like, it's not the Jerusalem that we're looking to have yet, so that we're still in exile. And this idea of Ephraim and Manasseh, what they were able to accomplish, that's what we want for our children. Can you be in a place of tremendous choshech? Can you be in a place of darkness? And darkness, we don't necessarily think of darkness only in terms of like the dark ages where things are terrible. Darkness can be a darkening of spiritual connection, where our eyes have been darkened spiritually. You can be wandering around again in the glitz and the glamour of Egypt, and we're saying, no, that's actually tremendous darkness there. It's harder to call something dark when it looks like it's really light, where it looks like it's really fun, where it looks like it's really festive, and it's very compelling, and it's just sucking us in. You wouldn't normally walk around and say, wow, this is a really dark place. We tend to think dark place means like, oh, poverty and crime and, you know, things that are, quote, terrible that everybody could recognize as darkness. Like, well, that's the easy darkness. We're talking about darkness that appears to be light. How can we recognize true spiritual light and hang on to that? Ephraim and Manasseh were able to do that. Yaakov is saying, they're going to be like Shvatim. They're going to be like the tribes. This is who the Jewish people need to bless their children by, because this is going to be the challenge that they have.
But Ellen, it's like who we bless our sons by. Right? So the message is for our sons to, but so what? I still don't get why the girls.
Why the girls get the imahot.
It's not a bad thing to have.
Yeah, the girls is actually, quote, the better. They get the better. Maybe, I don't know. This is me, Ellen Hutt, saying this. There is one opinion that says that all of our children should be blessed. You should be like Ephraim and Manasseh, not just the girls. But our tradition is that we bless the girls to be like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, because they had that quality as well. Uh-huh. Because each of them came from a family of idol worshiping. So Rebecca she lived, I mean, she was with her father, Betuel. I mean, they were evil people, and she was able to find spiritual light. Rachel and Leah, they grew up in Laban's household. It's like, how much darker could you get? And they were able to emerge. So they were really more like Ephraim and Manasseh on the female side. Isaac, what was his challenge? He grew up in Abraham's house. Yaakov grew up in Isaac's house. So they didn't have the same challenge as the women, as the mothers who were brought in, who were extracted from places of idolatry. They really represent the same concept. Okay, great question. Okay, in the blessing of the children after that. So now, I mean, if you were the Shvatim, if you were the 12 tribes, do you think like, how come those grandchildren got in? What about my? I mean, can you imagine the family arguments that could have been?
Progenitors. You know?
Yeah. What about everybody else? Like, what about so? What am I? Like, chop liver? Like, how? Why didn't you say like, be like Yehuda, be like whoever? All these other people. You could see, and interestingly, everyone must have accepted it because we know if there would have been a problem, we would have heard about it. Because we hear about every other problem. So we would have heard about it. There's no problem. They were accepted as tribes. It's really quite amazing.
And that blessing is so beautiful.
Its blessing is beautiful. It's inspiring, and people should have a real sense of what that is. What I'd like to do in our last few minutes is to talk about the blessing for Yehuda. Because the Jewish people are called Yehudim, from the tribe of Judah, looking at his blessing is also something very important for us to understand. Bethann, did you have a question related to that?
But I was thinking, you know, they were raised in exile, but they were raised by Joseph and Asna.
Right.
And Joseph in particular, it's like, what made him able to survive the dungeon and then this elevation to such a great place? How come he never felt abandoned by Hashem?
So he's called Yosef HaTzadik, Joseph the righteous person. And he, you know, in the Lulav and Etrog, he is represented by the Lulav of being strong. It is said that when he was tempted by Potiphar's wife, who's trying to seduce him, it says that he saw his father's face. And when he saw his father's face, that gave him the strength not to do it. And there was something also interesting. It says that Yosef looked like his father. So that he's like, he saw, like when you see yourself, it's like, and we say to somebody, how can they look in the mirror and do whatever it is that they do? It's like, can you look at yourself of who you're really meant to be and see the expectation and then fall off? That's why so it's a great question. When Yaakov finds out that Yosef is alive, he's obviously thrilled that he's physically living. But when he says, Od Yosef Chai, my son still lives, what he's responding to is that he's living as a Jew. And how did he possibly do that? Unbelievable that he was able to do that. And it was quite a process. And that goes back to why Yaakov gave him preferential treatment, is because when Joseph had his dreams about what he was dreaming about, Yaakov also had dreams. You know, there was like they were two peas in a pod there. He understood, and it says that Yaakov Shomer, he kept in mind what Yosef was dreaming about, and that he needed to prepare him because he knew that Yosef, like Yaakov, was going to spend a bulk of his life living in exile, as Yaakov did living with Laban. Like, how did Yaakov stay pure and upright and truthful and steadfast? He also grew up in exile. So Yaakov represents the progenitor of the person who lives in exile, which makes him the first perfect person to know these people, our people, are going to need preparation. We need to instill something here that people are going to be able to hang on to. Yosef, who is the carbon copy of Yaakov and lives in exile, and he lives in exile. I mean, at least Yaakov had Rachel and Leah. I mean, he had a family to kind of be a little family cluster. Yosef was completely on his own. Plus the fact that he was sold by his brothers, which doesn't really, like, if you're going to, it's interesting. I think, I know people, someone told me, like, they hadn't attended synagogue, they left their synagogue for 27 years because the rabbi said something insulting to their wife. I'm like, interesting. And you understand, it's like, people leave religion, like, if you have a reason to leave a religion, having your brothers sell you and thinking like your father didn't even send out a search party for you, that'd be a good reason to say, you know what, I'm not so big on being Jewish right now, I think I'll be Egyptian. Because he was certainly taken in by that culture, so where did he get that from? Said, he represents Yisod in the mystical tree of life. He represents in complete integrity. And that's in every sense of the way, to be able to not bend. And it's incredible. And we know, though, it's not a given, just because you have a parent or parents who are strong, not a given that the children will end up exactly the same way. So it is a tribute to Ephraim and Manasseh that they made the choices, not having any knowledge of Jacob's family. All they knew was what they learned from Yosef and Osnat. So an incredible, incredible success story there. So may our children be like Ephraim and Manasseh.
You were the children of Yosef?
Yes.
So then I always never could understand why there wasn't a tribe of Yosef.
That's why. It becomes divided. Ephraim and Manasseh go in, Yosef comes out, and Levi isn't counted either. Because Levi doesn't get land. So it depends. That's a good trick question. Is how many what are the 12 tribes? And your answer is, it depends. What are you counting? Mm-hmm. Jacob's sons, or the tribes according to their land, or what is it you're doing? And so that's a good trick question, because we have different counts depending on what we're talking about.
Oh, there are different counts?
Yeah, because if you say, who are Jacob's 12 sons, Joseph is included.
Joseph is included.
But who are the 12 tribes? We don't say Joseph, we say Ephraim and Manasseh and take out Levi. Yeah, so it's not so clear-cut. It's interesting. Okay, I'd like to spend a couple moments here on Yehuda on page 277, because it comes, and this is from the Sfas Emes commentary, which I read on Rabbi Siner's Dvar Torah on the Parsha, on page 277, verse 8. And let's take a look at what it says there. And Valerie, would you like to read?
Judah, you, your brothers, shall acknowledge your hand will be at your enemy's name. Your father's sons will prostrate themselves to you.
Okay, actually, yes, I'm sorry, read verse 9 too.
In lion cub is Judah, from the prey, my son, you elevated yourself. He crouches, lies down like a lion, and like an awesome lion, who dares rouse him?
Okay, great. Okay, and then it goes on and says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a scholar from among his descendants, etc. This is the message that the tribe of Yehuda will be the progenitors of kings. That's why we know the kingship comes from the tribe of Yehuda. And it has to do with who Yehuda is. So just to spend one moment to go back is, who was Yehuda? And the main story that we need to know about is the story of Yehuda and Tamar, which we discussed earlier, about Yehuda and Tamar, that Yehuda had two sons. His first son married Tamar. That son sinned. He died. And then because of Levirate marriage, which doesn't have to do with Levites, even though it sounds like Levirate marriage, that then Yehuda gave Tamar his second son, who didn't really want to carry on the name of his brother and refused to impregnate Tamar. And so then he dies. And so now Yehuda has two dead sons and this daughter-in-law, and tells her, go to your father's house, keep on your clothes of widowhood, and when the youngest son grows up, I will give you him to be the father, and then you can marry him and then have a child. Tamar sees that the son grows up and that Yehuda is not doing that, and so then she decides to take action on her own. She dresses as a prostitute. She goes out on the road. Yehuda's coming by with his assistant and is pulled to her. They have relations, but before they do, she says, he doesn't have anything to pay her with because he wasn't really planning on that activity. So she says, okay, give me your credit card, your keys, and your whatever, your staff, your signet, and your cloak, and then that will be collateral. He goes back to pay her afterwards, after the sheep shearing time, and she's not there. So he's like, I look like an idiot, so like, let's just go home and pretend this didn't happen. 3 months later, Tamar is showing, and everyone's saying, like, your daughter-in-law is pregnant somehow. It's like, oh, she must have been like a harlot, and brings her for judgment to Yehuda, who's like the king of each tribal head was like the king, and to have her killed. That is the punishment for adultery, because she was betrothed to Yehuda's youngest son. Betrothal is the same as marriage for all practical purposes, which is why in contemporary times we delay the real betrothal engagement until under the chuppah, just so we don't have any time between engagement and marriage, less because it's as complicated as marriage. So if someone says, I'm engaged, that's like, very nice mazel tov, not really until you're under the chuppah. Okay, so Tamar is going to be executed, and she says to Yehuda privately, by the way, the father of the child is the one to whom these things belong, and shows Yehuda his signet, his staff, and his cloak. It's like, said, "You are more righteous than I am," and he admits it right up front. Said, and then so that's the end. And then Tamar gives birth, and then that becomes the ancestor to King David and to the Mashiach. It says Mashiach comes from Yehuda because Yehuda comes from acknowledgement. The word Yehuda means to acknowledge. Hoda'ah means to give thanks. Vidui, which is also the root of that, means to acknowledge. It says Yehuda is all about acknowledgement and coming clean. So now picture this situation. Everyone says, like, well, would you have done the same thing in that position? And everyone says, oh, yeah, I would have done the same thing. It's like, no, you wouldn't have. If you were in charge, you first of all could have said, you know, this is, you could have had a rationalization. So this is what was so beautiful in Sfas Emes, is that Yehuda, and it says that these thoughts did go through his mind. It wasn't an automatic reaction. The thought did go through his mind of, this is so humiliating. This is going to kill my father. I mean, after everything else that has happened, he's lost Joseph because this is in between after Yosef has been sold and before they go down to Egypt, and Yehuda's supposed to be like this big shot, and now it's going to come out that he had, it was like okay halachically, but it was not nice that he had sexual relations with a prostitute, with someone acting as a prostitute. It's like, what are you doing? He said, the Chilul Hashem, the desecration of God's name. He could have, in his mind, rationalized that it would have been a Kiddush Hashem, it would have been a sanctification of God's name to just kill Tamar and be done with it, just so not to kill his father, that would just be the better situation. This is how rationalization works, where we take something that is wrong and we so twist it in our minds like this until the wrong thing is right. Or he could have done something else and saved himself embarrassment and said, there's been some new information that has come to light, and so we're going to have an investigation, and we're having a stay of execution, and blah, 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 and then she would have the baby, whatever, and then hope that just like all the uproar and the paparazzi would die down. So there would have been a number of ways he could have handled it that would have been totally understandable, and is a way that most people would have handled the situation if they could have. And he does something different. He says, I did that. That was wrong. Tamar, you're right. I'm really sorry. Let's take care of this. And he does that. Pam.
And the baby's name?
It's at the end. You have to go, I think, Peretz. I'm not sure. It's in the Parsha.
Whoever this is becomes the
progenitor of Boaz. Of Boaz, who becomes the husband of Ruth. And from there, Ruth has the baby who then becomes from the ancestor of, becomes King David, because Ruth is the great-grandmother of King David. So it says this is called the seed of kingship and the seed of redemption as well of Mashiach. Comes through Yehuda, and it comes from admitting in a way that makes him look to, imagine, can you imagine like all the wagging tongues? I was like, did you hear what Yehuda did? Can you believe that? Completely humiliating, but he doesn't care because he wants to do the right thing. Says, that's Yehuda, that's kingship. So that when Yaakov is blessing him, you, your brothers, shall acknowledge that because of the way Yehuda handled that, instead of making him the persona non grata, it actually elevated him in the eyes of everybody. It wasn't, because what do people really appreciate? A quick, sincere apology and admission. Don't dance around. It wasn't really sex, it was this, it was that. You know, like, admit it. What did you do? And King David later does the same thing with Bathsheba. When Nathan the prophet comes to him and kind of tells him like what he's done, he said, I sinned. He didn't say, you know, I'm the head of state, I can do whatever I want. You know, he could have done a lot of other things. He doesn't do that. He's from the tribe of Yehuda. Our kings and our leadership and our principled people are all about admission. But then it's interesting because Yehuda is described as not as a lion roaring in the forest, but it says he is crouching. On the top of page 279, he's crouching, lies down like a lion and like an awesome lion who dares rouse him. It says a lion, if you see a lion lying down, like you're in the zoo, you see a lion lying down, do you still know it's a lion? Mm-hmm. It's still a lion, okay? It doesn't have to be springing into action. But when a lion crouches, what happens when a lion crouches? What does that really mean? Is it about to happen? He's about to pounce. So he looks like he's down, but really he's ready to spring up. He says, that is our goal, is that when we face situations and we have done something wrong, and we have fallen, and we have to admit that we have done something wrong, we're supposed to be like Yehuda. Yes, it brings us down into a lying down, crouched position, but the resiliency, what are we supposed to do? You just admit what you did and dust yourself up off and you just spring right back into action. It says, be like a lion. It looks like they're lying down. It looks like they're down. But a lying down lion is still a lion. And lest you think like you fell so far and that you can never recover because it's so humiliating and what you did was so out of character for you or so bad or so wrong or so misguided. It's like, not so what that it doesn't matter. Admit it and then jump right back in. He says, that is Yehuda. It's like, you just jump right back into the game. You never see, like, on, I never watch them, but like boxing matches or whatever, and like the people get pummeled, and then they, like, in their corner looking, whatever. They get back in there, get back in the ring, get back in the ring. The person's like, oh God, how am I supposed to do that? It's like, get back in the ring, and sometimes you see that they take the kind of the springy ropes that are the ring, and they, like, spring them back, and then they, like, propel back, then back into the fight. It's like, you just do that. It looks like you're out, but you're not out. And a situation can come up in your life that looks like it just totally floored you and bottomed you out. It did not. There was always a possibility to be a lion. So people in Federation know the Lion of Judah. That's the symbol, is we are the lions. The Yehudim, just like you see on the flags that at least they used to have on Simchas Torah, always had the Lion of Judah on it. It says the Jewish people are lions, and we may look like we're down. Think about just even the Holocaust. We look like we couldn't have been more down and out than that, and that wasn't through wrongdoing. So it could be through wrongdoing or through something happens to you that seems like it, you just got the rug pulled out from under you and you're down, but you're not out. And be like a lion and spring right back into action. That's what makes us majestic. That's what makes the lion majestic. That's what makes the Jewish people majestic. The Jewish people are about to enter now into a time of tremendous pressure, tremendous challenge, tremendous darkness. And within that, they're going to have an incredible opportunity. Jacob blesses each of their children, each of his children, to tell them what their gifts and what their challenges are so that they will be able to persevere, teach their children and their children's children so that they can persevere until the end of the exile so that they will be able to really, truly be redeemed with an outstretched arm. Next week, we'll start the beginning of Shemot, the beginning of Exodus, and we jump ahead many, many years until we get to the birth of Moshe. Susan. I'm sorry, the Jewish people are about
to go into a period.
Yes, yes. In the Torah, they're about to enter this, and parallelly, we are in that place now. And again, it's very hard to call a place that looks so bright dark. And to say, can we see that there is darkness and know there's spiritual light and spiritual opportunity hiding deeply within every challenge that faces us. May we all really truly be blessed to be like Ephraim and Manasseh, our children, our families, our community, and be like Judah, and be like that lion crouching and waiting to just spring back into action. We never lose our royalty, no matter what happens. There's a story in, I'll just share this at the end, about a man who was, I don't know if it was in the Holocaust or what, but he had been a general or whatever, and he somehow managed to sneak his uniform in with him, and every night he would put it on, like in the darkness, and then he would change back into his POW outfit. And someone saw him one time and said, like, what are you doing? He said, I need to remind myself of who I really am and to not be impacted by the oppression that is around me. So there's lots of things out there. Some of them appear to be fun and amazing, and some appear to be as challenging as they really are, but to know that it's all a challenge and we're all up for it and the light is waiting for us to see it. Have a wonderful Shabbos and see you next week. Thank you.